Chapter 10, which is painted in obsession. Quote, quand je n'ai pas de rouge, je mets du bleu. Translation, when I don't have red, I use blue. Pablo Picasso. Pablo Picasso, although a Spaniard, lived much of his life in France, moving regularly from the gray skies of Paris to the golden light of the Côte d'Azur. The gallery at Antibes was set in the large, airy rooms of an ancient fortress that had been emptied and restored. Built to honor the time the artist had spent on the coast, the museum supplied the region's tourists with something famous they could recognize and pretend to understand. It was Harvey's first time in a museum, and he was overwhelmed. There had never been a genius so imaginative and varied as Picasso. He had mastered every type of expression on canvas. Harvey saw the examples of the fine-lined, classical sketches of his boyhood, the moody expressionism of his adolescence, the geometrical dissections of his cubist period, and finally his rediscovery of childhood in playful orgies of color and form. There were drawings of all kinds, some overwhelming with a fury of ink, others refreshing with a single line. But it was the tauromachia that shot an arrow through the captain's breast, slicing his aorta and lodging in his loins. Harvey felt he had found the creative counterpart of his own special gift, for Picasso had understood the truth. He had understood that each subject requires its own form of expression, that to paint an object, the painter must become the object and listen to its demands. The simple surfaces of impressionism were false. The brooding subjectivity of expressionism was false. But here was truth. Je dois peindre, I must paint, he exclaimed, turning down a corridor and racing to the next gallery. Mahogany followed him patiently through the museum, waiting in silence as Harvey examined each successive piece. Finally, after watching him study a three-line drawing for the better part of an hour, Mahogany was forced to interrupt and lead the captain back to the car. The sun was just above the hills as they walked along the harbor, and the sky had taken on the singular, unreal shade of pink unique to the French Riviera. It seemed to catch and hold the scattered seagulls that hung above the water, suspended on the moving air. When they reached the car, Harvey was too excited to drive, so Claude took the wheel and listened with interest as the captain described his experience in the gallery. In no time they were back in Carnoles, and Claude slowed the car to a gentle purr as he turned down a small street that led to the Cape. The sun was beginning to set, casting its long spokes of silver through the trees, and the coastal vegetation was alive in its tenderest green, each leaf and branch a lit-up miracle of illumination. As the rays washed over the youthful grasses, they gave the blades both an aggregate and individual splendor, and Harvey was reminded of himself and the many lives he led. Beyond the grasses, a single splash of light lingered on the sea, offset by the blue-black shadows in the distance, until the sun dipped behind the hills and the Cape fell dark beneath the glowing rose of the sky. Mahogany and Harvey dined that night with Claude and his wife, and Harvey continued to rhapsodize about his desire to paint. The hostess was uneasy in his presence, for Harvey's fixed, crazed eyes and extended moments of silence unnerved her, and she was startled by his repeated cry, "Je dois peindre!" Claude, on the other hand, had become exceedingly fond of the captain and his impeccable French, and he offered to rent him a studio apartment on the Cape, supplying him with the painting materials he required. Harvey wasted no time in accepting the offer, and began to work that night. Everything was clay for his mind, and all things spoke to him, demanding their own color and form. Harvey listened to the rocks and trees and animals, for only they could suggest the perfect medium for their expression. He painted wildly, obsessively, producing 100 pictures a day. Claude became frustrated, trying to keep him supplied with canvas and oils, and gave the job to Mahogany. The days passed, and Harvey immersed himself in the storm of his work. Eventually, Claude spoke to his friends about the captain's prodigious production, and they convinced him to get a critic to evaluate the paintings. When Claude took the idea to Harvey, he found Harvey sitting with a young woman beneath the branches of an olive tree. The narrator breaks in here. O goddess of artistic assistance, peerless princess Athena, do for this poor captain as your father would do for you, and help him win the scepter of success. The woman introduced herself as an art collector from Paris, a former artist herself, blacklisted by the École des Beaux-Arts, because she would not comply with their petty demands. She marveled at the unbelievable variety of Harvey's subjects, was struck with disbelief at the unbelievable mastery of his unbelievable techniques, and admired without end the unbelievable breadth and depth of his unbelievable imagination. She immediately called a friend in Paris and discovered there was to be an exposition of marginated painters that weekend in the Palais d'Industrie. Harvey and Mahogany could take the TGV the following morning and meet her in the afternoon at the gallery. When Harvey awoke the next day, he was nervous with Mahogany's excitement, and he accidentally cut his ear while shaving. He wrapped it in a bandage to stop the blood, but it was still bleeding at 10 o'clock when they boarded the train with 1,000 of Harvey's best works. The exposition opened at 3, and was attended by only the most severe critics of Paris, all of whom had come for this explicit pleasure of ridiculing the innovative artists. Footnote. Scribbled illegibly in the left margin of the original manuscript, Mr. Twelves has written, "One of the critics went so far as to arrive with a boombox, which he carried around the exposition, blasting out the Dire Straits song in the gallery." One critic in particular, standing in front of a canvas entitled Self-Portrait, Obsession Sunrise, remarked,
"Ce n'est que l'obsessionnisme dans l'art." "Oui, oui," nodded another. "Ce n'est que l'obsessionnisme." "Obsessionnisme," echoed another. "Oui, oui, c'est l'obsessionnisme." "Monsieur Capitaine Harvey, peintre obsessionniste." Bof.
Unaware of his critics, Harvey was engaged in conversation with the other painters at the show. Coincidentally, they all had the same first name. There was Adelfos Tiepolo from Toledo, Adelfo Lucientis from Madrid, Adelfos Pizarro from Chartres, Adelfos Yamamoto from Hokkaido, the twins Adelfos and Adelfos Young from Salt Lake City, and the lovely Adelphine Sanzio from Mantua. Suddenly, inexplicably, they had all developed the same variety of styles at the same time. They were gathered before one of Harvey's most striking canvases, Self-Portrait, Agapé sur l'herbe, and Adelfos had just recounted how, like his idol Manet, he had initially wanted to make a career in the Navy, but failed his physical and took up painting instead.
"Arrgh!" growled the painters in unison. "To see or not to see, that is the question."
Mahogany joined the artists and found them to be excessively intuitive and understanding. He was especially taken with the beautiful Adelphine, whom he invited for a walk on the Champs-Élysées. As the critics began to mingle with the artists, they too took a liking to the young painters. They were especially impressed with the artist's profound knowledge of criticism and politics in the art world. They had never met artists that understood art as well as the critics did, and soon the label Obsessionisme left their lips not with a whistle of scorn, but with a coo of approbation. Because of his bandaged ear, they singled out Harvey as the leader and sang praises to him of the new Révolution Obsessionniste. One of the critics invited Harvey and Claude to dinner, while Mahogany left with Adelphine.